Listen.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to speak to you standing up so I don't fall asleep. I am a creature of the night and would only accept an invitation to speak at this hour from the Philadelphia Society. However, the anxiety of appearing at this hour has meant that I've barely slept at all. But you, the day people are in charge, as we night people know. Now, Vic Milione was spoken of often during this meeting. And I remember one of the first things Vic told me, and it was something he repeated often. He said, civilization is only 10 years old at any given time because it takes a minimum of a decade to instill into someone the principles and substance of civilization. Now, I have four young children whom I always remind that they are barbarians. However, before they leave my house, they will be members of Western civilization. This does produce some resistance. I recall a conversation a year or two ago with my third child, a boy. I said, Matthew, take that knife out of your mouth. Only barbarians put knives in their mouths. He said, oh, I wish I could be a barbarian. And I said, why? He said, so I could put a knife in my mouth. So, you know, this is going to take some time, at least a decade. So I'm going to dedicate these remarks to Vic. So the name of this panel is The Role of the U.S. in Defending Western Civilization. Against whom are we defending it, and what is it that we are defending? Do we know? A recent commemoration of 9/11 generated a particularly thoughtful column in a British magazine called Spike by Frank Furedi, an atheist. Atheists may be especially sensitive to a lack of faith in others. Furedi thinks, quote, that a lack of clarity about what the West stands for has been made excruciatingly evident by the reaction to 9/11, which exposed and brought to the surface the difficulty Western society has in giving meaning to its way of life. He says, for a brief moment, many observers believed that 9/11 would represent a rallying point and provide the West with a sense of mission. However, in the absence of a coherent system of meaning, the West struggles to promote its own values. Instead, it relies on tawdry advertising and marketing and Britney Spears and other conveyors of the message. The focus on improving the image indicated that the U.S. was not prepared to engage in a serious battle of ideas, unquote. In a way, it may seem a bit disingenuous for an atheist to criticize the lack of coherent meaning in the West when such a lack is the inescapable conclusion to his own premise. That is, unless the meaning is self-given, from where else could it come if not from God? However, if it is self-given, then it's revocable and therefore not coherent. Well, the West is a whirl with such self-definitions based upon appetite and will with little connection to objective reality. And that is why we find ourselves babbling incoherently in the face of an assault by a very coherent enemy. In fact, our moral incoherence is what appalls so many Muslims who prize faith in God and family morality. The more immersed we are in abortion, pornography, drugs, homosexuality, and the breakup of the family, the more appalling we appear. For example, 32% of British Muslims, half a million people, believe that, quote, Western society is decadent and immoral and that Muslims should seek to bring it to an end, unquote. Belief will always trump unbelief, and the moral relativism under which so much of the West lives is simply a form of unbelief. At the very time that we're trying to attract Muslims to democracy, we in the West seem clueless that much of the Muslim world sees our presentation of freedom as morally empty. There was a prescient novel or a novella written in Great Britain before 9/11 by a Pakistani immigrant author. It was called My Son the Fanatic, and it was later made into a movie. And in this novel, the Pakistani immigrant father is very distressed by his radicalized son. And he says to him, "I don't understand you. I love this country. You can do anything here." And the radicalized son responds, "I know. That's the problem." Last summer in the Washington Post, there was a profile of one of the most important members of Al-Qaeda who was captured. He was the foremost explosive expert for them, Saad al-Husseini, a native of Morocco. Like many terrorists, Husseini came from a technical scientific background with little religious education. He was given a scholarship in chemistry for graduate study at the University of Valencia in Spain. According to the Post, his academic mentor said that when Husseini arrived, quote, "he was not visibly religious and would occasionally join students and faculties for drinks," unquote. Tapas bars? No problema. Then something changed. Quote, "he became radicalized in Spain after meeting a Tunisian friend," reports the Post. Quote, "our principal subjects of discussion were around the jihad," said Husseini. "He made me understand the importance of religion and faith, providing me with religious books and audio tapes of the great Sheikh's speeches," unquote. So Husseini abandoned his research into the anti-cancer properties of certain chemicals and began making bombs. This is particularly ironic in light of the U.S. program to fight breast cancer in the Middle East, which is touted as one of our public diplomacy successes. Husseini is a man whose research might have helped in the anti-cancer struggle. Instead of fighting cancer, however, Husseini thought it was more important to blow up the country from which the anti-cancer program had come. Why? What need in Husseini's life was met by his Al-Qaeda recruitment? Didn't this young man have the very freedom and educational opportunities for which many Muslims long? Don't we, in fact, think that providing these opportunities is the solution to the problem of terrorism? Here's another way to put it. There are some people who can survive without freedom because they have meaning in their lives. People like Solzhenitsyn, Aung San Suu Kyi. There are others who cannot survive freedom because they have no meaning in their lives. Husseini had freedom, but no meaning. So he chose meaning over freedom. His story has been replicated many times by Muslims in Europe and elsewhere, perhaps most recently by two young Swedes featured in a recent documentary, Aching Heart, Who Sold Their Lives to Please Allah, unquote. Thus, young Muslims, disoriented by the forces of globalization, are faced with the following choice from us. This is how they perceive the choice as being offered from the West. Greater freedom with no purpose, or personal submission to a higher purpose. Greater freedom with no purpose, or personal submission to a higher purpose. Which would you choose? If offered in this way, so long as our adversaries successfully frame the issue in these terms, and we encourage them to do so, we will lose. And it is why we are losing the war of ideas. We can win if we restore the sense of moral purpose that makes freedom a solution and not a problem. However, we are so confused over essential issues concerning the meanings of life, family, and moral worth that we cannot coherently articulate a set of ideas to project beyond saying we're for democracy. That does not work. As Harry Jaffa wrote in The Proposition in April 2006, we are, quote, telling others to accept the forms of our own political institutions without any reference to the principles or convictions that give rise to these institutions, unquote. Well, threats to national existence have a marvelous way of concentrating the mind on exactly why we have a moral right to exist, and in fact, an imperative to exist in a certain way. What, after all, was wrong with 9/11? As has often been remarked, it was an act of barbarism. But what does that mean? What is the moral import of an act of barbarism? One can only answer by defining what civilization is, the act of recognizing another person as a human being. The definition of a barbarian is someone who cannot perform this act, often because he has either come from or chosen a universe of meaning that does not contain the term human being. It's hard to overstate the catastrophe resulting from this incapacity or refusal. If one is unable to recognize another person as a human being, then one does not know the difference between the animal and the human, or the human and the divine. Confusion over these matters leads to slavery, human sacrifice, cannibalism, and other horrors. It also led to Nazism and communism, both of which denied a common humanity. Recall Hitler's exultant cry, "We are barbarians. We want to be barbarians. It is an honorable title." Now we're in another struggle, this time against Muslim radicals who assert their perverted standard of faith as the litmus test for life or death, share it or die. They serve an angry God who demands human sacrifice, first from other Muslims who do not subscribe to their darkness, and then from us. To fight this new war of ideas, we need to recover our own civilization in order to defend it. What I would like to do in a highly schematic way here is go over a few notions central to such a recovery. These are going to strike you as truisms. They are so familiar. However, as G.K. Chesterton said, the only problem with truisms is that you forget that they're true. One of the foundation stones of Western civilization is the idea that man is made in the image and likeness of God. This is singular. Find this notion in another creation narrative. It's not in the Quran. In fact, it's blasphemous to suggest that man is made in the likeness and image of God for a Muslim. Without this revelation, it is doubtful that we in the West would ever have seen its expression in political terms. I was reading Pope Benedict's latest encyclical, Spe Salvi, on hope, and came across this citation from one of the shortest letters in the New Testament that makes this point so eloquently, the letter to Philemon from Paul. Paul's writing from Rome, where he had been imprisoned, and he is sending back to a slave owner the slave who had run away from him, to Philemon. "I appeal to you," he says, "for my child, whose father I have become in my imprisonment. I am sending him back to you, sending my very heart. Perhaps this is why he was parted from you for a while, that you might have him back forever, no longer as a slave, but more than a slave, as a beloved brother," unquote. "Neither Greek nor Jew, neither free man nor slave." As Benedict comments, even if external structures remained unaltered, this changed society from within. And indeed, we are familiar with the political translation of this concept into all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Now, we know that God's image in man is tarnished because of man's disobedience, which severed the relationship between God and man, original sin, call it what you will. Man does not have it within his power to restore the relationship, but a Savior is promised who can do this for him. This is the origin of salvation history, the secularization of which is the idea of history itself as progression. This notion is also absent from the Quran. In the five iterations of the story in the Garden of Eden, it is very clear that man's disobedience there is no different from any other instance of man's disobedience in the Quran. There is no cataclysmic dislocation in the relationship between God and man. There is no relationship to begin with that needs to be restored. This makes the accounting for evil in the Quran a big problem, but it also removes the notion of salvation history. And if there is no salvation history, is there indeed history? It is key that man did not have it within his means to effect his own salvation. That became available only through a transcendent act of God in intervening in history through the incarnation, as Christians believe. In this, there is a huge significance for the struggle today. Christ said his kingdom was not of this world, or his legions would have come to defend him. His kingdom transcends the world, so you can give to Caesar what is Caesar's without transgressing his kingdom. Thus, politics here is provisional. It is limited. It is not salvific. Heaven and earth are ever distinct. The transcendent, not politics, is the source of meaning. In what I think is one of the most beautiful statements in Greek philosophy, Socrates adumbrates this truth and reveals the other source through which we can come to recognize another person as a human being, reason, philosophy, that our souls are all ordered to the same transcendent good, expressed by Socrates as a city, but not of this world. As you may recall from this extraordinary passage from the Republic, he says, quote, "In heaven there is laid up a pattern of it, of this ideal city, which he who desires may behold." In other words, you can come to know this heavenly city. "And beholding may set his own house in order. But whether such a one exists or ever will exist, in fact, does not matter." Building this city here is not a project. "For he will live after the manner of that city, having nothing to do with any other." Unquote. In other words, the good and the wise will live according to a spiritual order that transcends the actual order as well as the particular in which the individual lives. Indeed, Socrates' transcendent view beautifully adumbrates St. Paul's prophecy, "As you well know." As you well know, we have our true citizenship in heaven. And it is Socrates who first pointed to and warned against what happens if you try to transpose the spiritual order into the political order to achieve by political means ultimate spiritual ends. If you try to merge that heavenly city with the earthly city, what St. Augustine called the city of God and the city of man. If you try to merge those, what happens? Socrates showed in the Republic, by creating this proto-totalitarian state, the abolition of the private, the regimentation of society, eugenics, etc. And we have seen in the West such states created in the 20th century. Today we have a different non-Western ideology based upon the fundamental error of conflating heaven and earth in a deformed theology. I'm just going to give you a couple of citations to make this point, one from the primary ideologue of the Muslim Brotherhood, the single most popular and read Islamist ideologue in the world today, Sayyid Qutb. He was hanged in 1966, but his works proliferate throughout the Muslim world. What did he say the project was? Quote, "The ultimate objective is to reestablish the kingdom of God upon earth." That is not a political goal. It's an eschatological one. Qutb further said, "Islam chose to unite earth and heaven in a single system." Remember how many times we have heard in this society, don't let them immanentize the eschaton? Well, here it is, folks. We are uniting heaven and earth in a single system. Islamists don't flinch from the implications of this politically, and they spell it out specifically. Maulan Maududi, the Pakistani Islamist ideologue, said, "What does this Islamist state look like?" Quote, "In such a state, no one can regard any field of his affairs as personal and private. Considered from this aspect, the Islamic state bears a kind of resemblance to the fascist and communist states." Unquote. What a surprise. He remarked also that this would be, quote, "the very antithesis of secular Western democracy," unquote. And Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, said that the Soviet Union under Stalin was a model of a successful one-party system. Qutb himself said just dictatorship would grant political liberties to the virtuous alone, a line worthy of Robespierre. Just dictatorship would grant political liberties to the virtuous alone. Maybe they, instead of calling them Islamo-fascists, they should have been called Islamo-Jacobins. I'll give you just one citation from a current Islamist ideologue to update this for you. Suleiman Abu Ghaith is the principal spokesman for al-Qaeda today. He says, quote, "America is the head of heresy in our modern world, and it leads an infidel democratic regime that is based upon separation of religion and state and on ruling the people by the people via legislating laws that contradict the way of Allah and permit what Allah has prohibited." His colleague said, "What threatens the future of Islam, in fact, its very survival, is American democracy." To conclude, our role in defending Western civilization is to show that this so-called secular position, criticized by Abu Ghaith, is not secular at all. It is based upon a transcendent perspective and preserves a hierarchy of good according to the nature of things from their creator. That is, it is ultimately grounded in a profound theological view that sees all things in their relationship to God. It comes from a God who wants us to be free so we can freely choose him. Several years ago, I was speaking in the Balkans on the roots of Islamist ideology to a small group of Europeans. When I finished, they seemed to go into a state of shock. What I had said, they told me, had confirmed their worst fears. "What should we do?" they asked. The answer was one that even Mr. Ferretti might approve of. First, recover your faith. Thank you.